University of Wisconsin Stevens Point faced some mixed reactions when it was learned recently it uses a list of racial microaggressions in new faculty and staff training. We'll discuss the words and phrases and actions that are on the microaggressions list and welcome your thoughts and questions. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8.5 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Wednesday, July 8th. Here is an excerpt from Fox and Friends when the commentators were discussing one of the racial microaggressions that was on the list used by UW Stevens Point.
If you ask an Asian to help you with your math or science problem, that is a microaggression.
Right. The thing that people need to understand about this, and I write about it in my book, is that this is speech policing. This is basically very chilling to speech because it is making people feel like, I mean, if these things are out of bounds, then wouldn't you just be afraid to say anything?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? I mean, because if you're going to be accused of a racial microaggression, you're an aggressor against somebody, almost akin to a physical attack, I think that it's going to really put fear in people to even be able to talk to other people because they're going to think, oh my gosh, can I ask a student in my class who I know is good at math who happens to be Asian to help me? No, because that makes me a racist, so I'm just not going to do anything.
So what is a racial microaggression? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Daryl Wing Su is a professor of psychology and education at Columbia University. He has authored several books. His most recent are Microaggressions in Everyday Life and Race and Talk and the Conspiracy of Silence. Again, Daryl Wing Su is a professor of psychology and education at Columbia University's Teachers College. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
Thank you for joining us. Now, am I correct that this list of microaggressions used by the University of Wisconsin Stevens Point was developed by you?
Actually, what I developed was a table of examples of microaggressions, and they've adapted it. I think the University of California system and the University of Wisconsin have adapted and added additional phrases and statements that serve as microaggressions.
Yeah. What's your reaction to the some negative reaction to UW Stevens Point using this table?
Well, you know, the thing is that you know, I've been aware of people who have been critical of it. Racial microaggressions are real. They are verbal, nonverbal, environmental, insidious in their function and operation. The research and science that we developed, these statements were not drawn out of the air. They were based upon now close to 5,000 studies that deal with the potential harm and impact. Microaggressions are the everyday slights, indignities, put-downs, insults, invalidations that marginalized group members experience in their day-to-day interactions with well-intentioned individuals who are unaware that they are delivering a race-based or gender-based microaggression. The problem with microaggressions using this table is to pull out phrases out of the context. To understand microaggressions, you have to understand the context in which it is being delivered. I oftentimes get complimented for speaking good English. Now, when I was young, I never understood why it was that I felt uncomfortable, because after all, the person was complimenting me. They meant well. But the hidden communication that our research began to uncover was that the person on an implicit, unconscious level was saying to me that you are a perpetual alien in your own country, that you are not a true American. And when you don't understand what we call the unconscious metacommunication, the statements on the surface appear very reasonable and indeed doesn't have that bias that is going on. But those are the things that make microaggression so difficult to understand.
Yeah, so tell us why asking an Asian person to help with math is a microaggression.
On the surface alone, it may not be a microaggression. However, if the person is operating from a preconceived notion, like a stereotype, that all Asians are good with numbers, good with math, good in the sciences, but poor in people relationships, poor, if that is the thought, and by the way, women experience that too. They experience gender microaggressions that inevitably label them as being poor in math and the sciences. And it's those statements that you have to understand the context before you can say they are microaggressions. I mean, even Freud once said that even an apple can be an apple. And that's the dilemma, that microaggressions oftentimes are not microaggressions. And I think that the table that the University of Wisconsin is using is giving it as examples of possible microaggressions, not that all of these at all times represent microaggressions. Mm-hmm. And that's a misunderstanding, I think, that people have.
What is the harm if it is a microaggression?
Okay, you know, the harm, and this comes from studies. So we talk about impact of the microaggressions. We find, for example, that students of color on major campuses experience the school climate or campus climate as isolating, alienating, that they often experience being the only one that leads to feelings of isolation and loneliness, that they have their racial and gender identities assailed, and psychological well-being from the studies that we've conducted are clear that the more microaggressions that people of color experience in our studies that are conducted weekly, the more psychological well-being is diminished.
Yeah. One of the racial microaggressions on the table, or possible racial microaggressions on the table, was the phrase, "America is a melting pot." Why is that considered a microaggression?
Because it is not based on reality. If you look at the history of the United States, white Europeans who immigrated to the United States could assimilate and acculturate. Now, as a person of color, if you are African American, Asian American, Native American, no matter how westernized I become, there are doors in this society that are shut to me. I can be very Western in my values and behavior, but because I am not white, there are doors that are always closed to me. And, you know, in some ways, America is a melting pot, is linked to the belief of equal access and opportunities. If you only become westernized, you will enjoy the fruits of the labor. I mean, women know this. If they can act like men in the corporate world, they're promised that they will advance and move on. And that's not true. They don't advance because there are structural bias and limitations that prevent them from moving forward.
Karen on Facebook says, in educational circles, we have replaced the term melting pot with salad bowl, as each ingredient adds to and makes a much better salad. A reaction?
I think that's an excellent analysis, that the beauty is differences. It's not to eliminate assimilate and acculturate, where everyone becomes the same. The beauty is in the differences. That if you use a salad analogy, you have the green lettuce, the red tomatoes, the bell peppers, the colorfulness additively makes it very positive. And I like that analogy.
Our guest is Darryl Dwing Su, a professor of psychology and education at Columbia University's Teachers College. He is the author of several books, including Microaggressions in Everyday Life. And we are talking about microaggressions and talking about why they are a big deal. And we wonder if you think they are or not. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. We'll check news and then we'll take your calls. This is the Ideas Network. We are talking about microaggressions during this hour. The University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point's use of a table of microaggressions during faculty training was criticized on some national news outlets recently as being chilling to free speech. The University of Wisconsin says it's not banning any speech, but it uses this table that was adapted by a list that our first guest this morning created as a discussion item during faculty and staff training sessions to discuss these phrases and terms that are considered to be offensive and harmful to persons of color. And for that matter, there's gender microaggressions as well. We are talking about microaggressions and welcoming your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. By the way, the table that was used in the UW-Stevens Point training is posted on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page, so you can see more of the phrases, words, and terms. Bill in Columbus is with us. Hello, Bill.
Hi, great show. You know, I'm a vet, and I returned to college after deployment, and I experienced isolation and feelings of loneliness because the greater community didn't understand me, and I'm a white male, so that those feelings are completely universal in everyone on one specific topic. And I think that this microaggression topic is really a bunch of bull. It is exactly the reason we can't have a reasonable discourse on controversial issues, because everyone's afraid to offend anyone else. We don't need Stalin or a Marxist dictator suppressing us. We're doing it to ourselves.
Yeah. What if it's more than being offended, Bill, but it's harmful?
Well, if it's overt or malicious, it needs to be addressed. And I had to address, you know, so-called anti-war bias when I was in college, and I had to stand up in front of an English class and say, "You're wrong. That's not what we experienced." And then give my experience. And once I did, there was a greater understanding. But, you have to do that in order, you have to have a conversation. And this microaggression stuff, all it does is shut down conversation.
Yeah. Professor Su?
Really, two very good points. One of them, I think that we've all got to notice and note consistently, is that we all commit racial, gender, sexual orientation blunders. We commit it all the time, unintentionally, unconsciously, or intentionally. This occurs, and that one of the important elements is that it's how you recover, not how you cover up. It's not becoming defensive. When someone says something that I say something that offends another individual, I don't want to be dismissed outright without being educated and learn about what microaggressions are. The other thing I think I would emphasize is that Bill talks about being a vet and coming back. You know, and I can really understand what he is saying, the feeling of invalidation, of isolation and loneliness. There is some difference, however, that makes microaggressions different from the everyday slights and incivilities that people experience. And I don't mean to diminish what he is saying, but racial, gender, sexual orientation microaggressions are different in that they are constant and continual. A person of color from the moment of birth experiences microaggressions. They are cumulative, and anyone can break the camel's back. Now, Bill might not realize that I've experienced 5 microaggressions already since the end of last week. They are invisible, and they are constant reminders of my second-class status in this society. It also symbolizes when you experience a microaggression, past historic injustices, the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II, the enslavement of African Americans, the taking. It's a constant historical reminder of how we are treated in this society. And it is longstanding and cumulative. And as I've indicated, very harmful. They are not trivial, insignificant.
Yeah, and what examples of microaggressions have you experienced just in the last few days?
You know, for example, asking me where I was born after I gave a presentation, being invisible in line, being served by someone, others being served first. I mean, these are things that that I think that I experience as an Asian American. African Americans are constantly experiencing microaggressions of criminality, distrust, on and on. These things are frequent in the life of individuals. Even having a colleague at a meeting, I'm the only person of color there, all of a sudden saying that we need to have a person, we don't have a person of color in our committee here. And in that sense, there's an invalidation of who I am as an Asian American, that I do not belong to this. I'm invisible.
When you say that it's constant and continual and it eventually could break the camel's back, what exactly are the real side effects from microaggressions?
Okay. There is, like I was saying, lower subjective well-being, mental health types of problems, physical problems, because when you experience a microaggression, you're in a state of physiological arousal. And that physiological arousal has indicated that it translates into physical health problems. Microaggressions also create inequities in employment, education, and healthcare, because the studies on education, for example, one that came out recently called Toxic Rain, Microaggressions in the Classroom, indicate that when microaggressions occur, learning diminishes. The ability of students of color to be open to learning diminishes. In the world of work productivity diminishes. And so there is so broad in terms of the impact. And people, like I was saying, don't see. It's invisible, and the invisibility, like the glass ceiling, affects not only one's personal well-being, but their standard of living in terms of hiring, promotion, retention, education, and so forth.
Carolyn Oconomowoc is with us. Hello, Carol.
Hello, good morning. I tend to agree with the previous caller. Not necessarily that microaggressions don't exist. and that they're not good. But I think context is important here. I disagree with the examples being cited. So if there is true discrimination, that to me comes with saying something in a generality, like saying the intention of a person who asks an Asian for help on their math is negative. Saying that, you know, a woman knows that she needs to act like a man, but she still won't get ahead. Those are discriminatory examples, even, because what you're doing is the exact same thing that you're complaining about. You're saying that, in general, I'm going to take the context of what you are saying and put my own meaning to it. And that's wrong. I mean, I agree with the previous caller that when you have open communications and people are reaching out to one another, if I want to compliment someone on their language, I certainly don't mean that I'm reminding them that they're not an American. Maybe I am complimenting them that they've overcome some hardship that I think is very, commendable.
Professor Sue?
Well, you know, I can understand what the caller is saying here. But, you know, this is the major difference between one's awareness of what a microaggression is and the implicit assumption. There's a difference between explicit beliefs and implicit beliefs. And there, you know, what we're dealing here with what I call a clash of racial realities. The person delivering a microaggression on the conscious level is believing that they're complimenting the person or saying something out of context that is not biased. The implicit assumption represents a worldview from which people of color, let's say, are perceiving. And their people of color have a different racial reality than white individuals. Now, then you can ask the question of whose racial reality is the correct reality. And at this point, I guess I would go again to the social psychological literature that suggests that the most disempowered individuals are ones that have the most accurate perceptions of what is going on. And this makes sense to me, because for women to do well in a male corporate world, they have to understand the thinking of men. But men do not have to understand the thinking of women to do well. The same thing with people of color. As a person of color, to do well in the society, I have to really understand the beliefs, the attitudes, the structures, the values of the larger white society. But my white brothers and sisters don't need to understand what it is like to be an Asian American. So we do deal here with a clash of racial realities, and I don't doubt the fact that people who are making these statements are making them unintentionally. And that's why, in some ways, I'm against banning the language, because I see them as educational rather than being politically correct, that we're talking about education. As a psychologist, to keep my license and to practice, I have to undergo continuing education. And there are things I learn that I never knew before. And I feel the same way with faculty, that they are dealing now with a changing demographic population. And it's not a matter of being politically correct. It's a matter of them understanding on an educational level the worldview of their students who differ from them in terms of race, culture, gender, and ethnicity, as also sexual orientation, if you really want to be a good professor.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for educating us. We appreciate your time. Hopefully we can do this in the future again.
All right. Thank you.
Daryl Wang Su, a professor of psychology and education at Columbia University's Teachers College. He's authored several books, including Microaggressions in Everyday Life. And it was a table that he created that was adapted and is being used at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point in faculty training sessions. And it was discovered and criticized in some national news outlets recently as being chilling to free speech, and some commentators were questioning the validity of the concept of microaggressions. Now we welcome in another guest who first brought the issue of microaggressions to our attention. She was on this show recently talking, actually it was last year, talking about microaggressions. Gloria Ladson-Billings is a professor of urban education, curriculum and instruction, and education policy studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. So what is your reaction to UW-Stevens Point training their faculty about microaggressions?
Well, I guess in the general sense, I understand why they would have the conversation. I'm a little less sanguine about the notion that you produce some list of do's and don'ts. And I guess, you know, I did have a chance to listen to your earlier guest who comes at this from a psychological perspective. My own training is in anthropology, so I would come at it from a more cultural perspective. And I'm worried that you end up with kind of a static way, oh, here's what you should say or shouldn't say. I don't think you can ever regulate speech in this way, and institutions are very bad at it.
Yeah.
It's just not the way to do it. And I think the whole issue of, quote, what are microaggressions and why it's important to even think about them is that our society is filled with instances of really horrible things that happen, and that's what we rally around. But those horrible things really reflect sometimes, you know, often reflect what I call a thousand tiny cuts. And Dr. Su talked about these sort of daily, everyday interactions. So we've all, as a nation, been mourning what happened in Charleston, South Carolina. That was not a microaggression. That was an aggression. That was a terrorist attack. But we are responding to it around the microaggression of the flag, the Confederate flag.
No.
So think about this. If you are a white Southerner, you walk by the Columbia, South Carolina State House, you see the flag, you shrug your shoulders. Or if you're a student at Ole Miss, you go to a football game and people fly the Confederate flag. It's not a big deal to you. But if you happen to be African American, that walking by that flag each day may feel so uncomfortable and intimidating. So I think that's an example where a Professor Su was saying, you know, people on one side might say, well, that's not a big deal, whereas other people are saying, I feel threatened by that. So the big incidents that happen when people get the KKK spray painted on their house or a noose hanging off their door, we can all identify those, but it's the everyday indignities, I think, that people suffer that constitute these microaggressions. And I'm just not certain that they're things that can be legislated or regulated. I think it's important to have the conversations, but I think the place where, maybe UW-Stevens Point has had, you know, run into problems here may be around the fact that you produce some sort of static list.
Yeah. And UW-Stevens Point does say that it's used as a discussion item and that they're not banning anything. But in any case, we have a news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio coming up next, and then we'll continue talking with Gloria Ladson-Billings, a professor of urban education, curriculum and instruction, and education policy studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And we'll get some specific microaggressions that she has experienced when we come back. And we wonder if you have experienced microaggressions. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about microaggressions and why they are a big deal, and wondering if you agree or not, or if you have some questions about what a microaggression is, or an example. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page, or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our previous guest, Professor Sue, talked about some specific microaggressions that he has experienced just in the last week. He said a half a dozen or so, I think. He said one of them was someone asking him, he is an Asian American, do you speak English so well? Or someone who asked, where are you from? Someone who, on a search and screen committee that he was serving on, making mention that there are no that the search and screen committee needs a person of color on it, needs more diversity, when he was sitting on the search and screen committee. So those were some examples that he gave of microaggressions that made him feel as though he didn't belong, that he was, as he put it, an alien in his own land. For instance, that Asian Americans are often assumed to be foreign-born. Now let's ask our guest now, Gloria Ladson-Billings, a professor of urban education, curriculum and instruction, and education policy studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Have you, Professor Ladson-Billings, experienced any microaggressions recently?
Yeah, it's I guess it just comes with the territory, and as I said, you know, they're often just really tiny slights where people assume, well, you couldn't possibly know or be able to do certain things. I travel frequently. I'm getting on a plane tomorrow. And because I travel so frequently, I'm often upgraded. And so when they call for your groups to come up, you know, or global travelers, medallions, whatever the term is, I'll walk towards the counter, and it's not unusual for the ticket agents to say to me, are you platinum or are you group one? I mean, to, quote, check, while not saying that to any of the other passengers getting on, almost all who are white and male, because that's usually a business class. Now, I'm not flustered by this, but I do recognize where it's coming from.
Let's take a call. Carol in Madison has an example, too, I think. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm white. I very much believe that this is real, and people really need to pay attention, because I work with an African-American woman, and she gave me an example that I think really is a good one. She is a UW student, and she's done everything everybody else had to do to get in. And she was describing the situation in which she was at a class, and it was a very crowded class, and she's sitting in one of the seats. But the only two seats that are available are right next to her, on either side of her. And people are spilling out into the hall, but no one is sitting next to her. And the professor doesn't say anything about, come on in and sit down, there are two seats here, nothing like that. It was all allowed, you know, and of course she felt isolated, you know, and she told me about her feelings of isolation, and I just thought, my God, and it wasn't the only time she's experienced that. And I definitely think it's real. It might be unconscious, but it's real, and it needs to be made conscious. I feel like the professor should have done something in that case.
Yeah. Well, your reaction to that, Professor Ladson-Billings?
Yeah, I've seen students be left out. I often do professional development with our local schools, and I went to one of our schools and met with all the students of color. And, you know, I want to be clear. I don't go in and say to kids, what microaggressions have you experienced or what racism have you? I ask the kids very simple questions. Tell me what you like best about being a student here, and tell me what you like least about. Very sort of innocuous questions. The first question is pretty easy to get through because kids, most kids will tell you, they don't like a whole lot of things about school. So they said something like, oh, we have a long lunch period. We have really great computer technology. But when we got to the question about what they liked least about school, one of the young women said to me, and she was African-American, that she was the only African-American in her laboratory science class, and there was an uneven number of students. And when the teacher asked the students to pair up for the lab projects, she never had a partner. She said, so I've, you know, as a consequence, I've done twice as much work as everybody else because no one will be my partner. And I'm not going to beg them to be my partner. She says, when I have told the teacher, hey, I don't have a partner, he just merely says, oh, okay, you can work by yourself. So that's over and over and over. Over the course of a year, this young woman is always excluded. Now, you know, I think, and I explained to her that that's really kind of a pedagogical. There's nothing magic about two people in a lab group. There could be three. There could be four. And that's something the teacher would have to pay attention to.
Yeah, and so microaggressions are it's not just speech. It's not words. It's action. Their actions are involved here.
Yeah.
Let's take this comment from Rich on Facebook. Gay people are subjected again and again to assumptions, particularly if they are so-called normal acting, behaving, and looking. My partner and I have been asked repeatedly when out dining, well, you gentlemen are out this weekend without your wives. Outsiders may characterize this as a friendly observation. Trust me, from the inside, such observations do not seem friendly. They seem ill-informed and intrusive. What about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are ways in which we have created what we think constitutes normalcy. So while, you know, someone may be gay and work and in a workplace, and every Monday people come back and talk about what they did over the weekend, and they feel really comfortable talking about spouses and partners, and other people may feel like, oh man, I can't say anything about that, or I can't have photographs on my desk because it will, you know, say something about me that I'm not comfortable letting people know in this environment, or this environment hasn't indicated that it's okay for me to participate in that same way. So, and I think that Professor Sue alluded to that sexuality is one of those places where microaggressions occur.
Yeah, so what do you say to those? We have many comments on Facebook saying, well, you know, what's the big deal? But also concerned that this is chilling speech and we're never going to be able to communicate and people are afraid to say anything for fear of offending someone.
Well, I'm also one who has said I think it's not a good idea to try to regulate. You know, I think it's sort of antithetical to the notion of free speech. And I don't think it represents what we would classically call hate speech. But I think we have to have the conversations. We have to develop some level of empathy. And, you know, I think Maya Angelou says it best. Actually, it's two things she says that make sense here. Number one, when we know better, we do better. But I think the second thing that she says is people won't remember what you said to them. They'll remember how you made them feel. And that's the place we have to get to in our conversations with people. I know you said X, Y, or Z, and I know you didn't mean anything mean-spirited, but this is how it made me feel. And I think we have to have those conversations. I don't think the way we get at this is by inhibiting what people say.
So how do we learn to communicate effectively and hopefully avoid microaggressions?
Well, I think we'll be in a place as we look at the demographic shifts where we won't have any choice. I think we are becoming an increasingly diverse society and an increasingly global context. So we're going to always want to know how we can better communicate with each other. And I just think that that will come with more interactions. Mm-hmm. I think that the worst thing we could do is keep ourselves in kind of racial, ethnic, gender, sexual identification enclaves where we only talk to people who are exactly like us.
We have Haria on Facebook who says, I think people of color should determine what language is offensive and spell it out for the public. Then university staff can avoid that language. It's insensitive and frankly vulgar to say, well, I don't feel offended by it if you are not a person of color. Essentially, white people shouldn't get to decide what language to use when discussing issues affecting people of color. Do you agree or not?
Well, I think the problem, I know where she's coming from. I'm presuming it's a she, maybe he. But here's one of the challenges. If we get to a place where people feel they can't even open their mouths, then we lose all opportunity to really grow and learn. I had an example once many years ago when I was here at the university. And I came from a very diverse place. I came from California here. So it was a bit of a culture shock for me. And I remember someone right after the O.J. Simpson trial, colleague, a nice person, but I'm one of two African Americans in the faculty at the time. There were 50 faculty members, and there's two of us. And this one person said to me, so Gloria, what do black people think about the O.J. Simpson verdict? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I don't think they came from a place of mean-spiritedness, but I have a fairly thick skin and I'm pretty quick on the uptake for some of this stuff. So I just turned to the person and said, I don't know. What do white people think?
Well, that got your point across.
And at that moment, that person said, oh, wow. Yeah. I don't know why But if I had just walked away and, grumbling about it, the person would never have really thought about, oh, I was making an assumption that all black people think the same thing.
Yeah, and we're going to have to leave it there because we are out of time. We'll pick this up another time. Thank you very much for being with us.
You're quite welcome.
Gloria Ladson-Billings, Professor of Urban Education, Curriculum and Instruction and Education Policy Studies at UW-Madison. Thanks to Kayla Blato and to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. I'm Joy Cardine. The Big Question is next here on the Ideas Network.